This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the official EFL podcast with me, Mark Clement. And football is back in more ways than one. As we record this, we're just a couple of days away from the first of 1,671 EFL games to be played between now and the end of next May. And you're back too, in stark contrast to the whole of last season and the end of the previous one. With COVID restrictions lifted, Sky Bet Championship, League One and League Two fixtures are set to be played in front of full crowds again for the first time since March 2020. We'll look ahead to whose supporters might be celebrating in 9 months' time as we preview the 2021-22 season on the official EFL podcast. There's only one place we can start the first episode of the season of the official EFL podcast with a man who knows only too well about the effects of COVID-19. After contracting it in the middle of January, his severe symptoms were also accompanied by emphysema and a punctured lung. After an initial 33 days in hospital, he came home only to suffer a relapse and in total spent 69 out of 80 days in bed when he wasn't in intensive care managing Shrewsbury Town remotely. We couldn't be happier to be talking to Steve Cottrell. I'm wondering how many times you've answered the question, just how scary was it, Steve?
Well, it was scary. I mean, I think, you know, for somebody who doesn't suffer with coughs and colds and all of that business, you know, to have that was very scary because, you know, one of the important things you read in stories about COVID, in the first paragraph, you'll see the word debilitating. And then what happens is people get past that word that's nearly always in the first paragraph because you want to get into the emotional side of the story and find out what the story is about because there's always a story behind it. But debilitating is probably the best word to describe it. You know, it is awful. I mean, just, you know, getting out of bed and being on oxygen and trying to use a commode to go to the toilet, you know, just all of those things, they absolutely knock you for six. You know, my heart rate monitor used to go through the roof, just sort of lifting myself out of bed and getting onto a commode just to go to the toilet, things that we take for granted every day of the week. So, incredibly tough. I mean, we definitely wouldn't have enough time on this podcast to talk about COVID and, you know, where I've been with it and where a lot of other people have been with it as well. But thankfully, I'm here to tell the tale and try and help others with little bits of advice here and there and to carry on my career in football.
I mean, for a man whose energy levels have always been high, that's the one thing that's always struck me whenever we've met up or talked on the telephone. Mm. That is a frightening, frightening situation to find yourself in where your kind of skill set and everything that you hold dear and the essence of you is not usable.
Like I just said, you know, there it's, we need 20% oxygen to live. That's what we breathe every day of the week that, you know, we obviously take for granted. And when I got hospitalised down in Bristol, I needed 91% when I got in the door. So wow. I think that probably just goes to show how far down the line I was with not being very well, really.
Do you know how you caught it?
I mean, the first thing I would say is I don't think there was enough protection last year with testing because I think that our squad and maybe even myself would have had it long before we were all tested because we'd had two or three lads go down with it. Then we had a game cancelled against Crewe. And I remember doing a training session down at the ground and ended up standing in the training session and working in the training session. And I felt really, really tired at the end of it. And I actually think that 9 out of 10, when we get coughs and colds, it will be because it's cough and cold season and a lot of us are tired and we are looking for a break from work in and around that Christmas period. If you look at a lot of managers and coaches, whenever they come on and they do their TV interviews, 9 out of 10 after Christmas, you'll see a few of them, you know, with a little bit of coughs and colds and, you know, they're a bit low or some, you know, carry cold sores, don't they? And you think, you know what that is? That's the stress and strain of the job and all of those games in such a short space of time. And I think that I caught it because my immunities were lower after being here for a month. There was a lot of work done in that first month. Lots of hours worked, lots of days, no breaks. And I think my immunity that day, it just dropped so much. I think then I may well have had COVID, but because we weren't testing, no one was testing at that period of time. I think I might have already had it, but when my immunities went even lower, I think that's when it got me, which is why I've said in a previous interview that I've done that, you know, if you're feeling a bit fatigued, take it easy, because I truly believe that it was the fatigue bit in it that's why it grabbed hold of me so hard.
Steve, are you fighting almost a disbelief when you find yourself in that situation? I mean, you're a football obsessive. Were you trying to hang on to the job, but your body, your mind was just not able to remotely deal with anything work-related at all?
No, because I was working right up until the following day on that Friday when I got tested on the Saturday morning. And it was only when I got tested on a Saturday morning, because on the Friday night when I went to bed, I remember waking up in the middle of the night and the sheets were soaked. And then I thought, maybe I've just picked up a cold or something like that, maybe flu, because we'd not long had flu jabs in November. So I thought maybe it was just that. Then when I come down and I had a positive test, the next 4 or 5 days, I went really down. It was isolated in a hotel in Shrewsbury, and for about 10 days, I know that I lost probably a stone and a half.
Wow.
I couldn't eat. I just couldn't face anything. You know, I was waking up in the morning. I would have a cup of coffee for breakfast, nothing else. I would go back to bed. I would get up. I don't know why I got up at lunchtime, but for whatever reason, a bath was somewhat comforting. But I don't know whether that was doing me any good or not. But I remember getting in a bath, and then I would get back out and I'd put on a toweling robe and I'd get straight back into bed, and it was like Groundhog Day for about 10 days. Then when I finally went home, because I needed to isolate for 10 days, I ended up then going into Bristol Royal Infirmary. My old club doctor at Bristol City came along and he got me an ambulance. And then I went in an ambulance, and I sat in the ambulance car park for probably an hour or so before you go into a holding room. And then the holding room, I was in there for probably 12 to 14 hours, you know, just having bloods and tests and, you know, I think just about every needle a going put in you, before I was allowed up into the COVID ward, where that's where I spent a fair bit of time in a isolated room. But, you know, I can't thank the people enough, probably, for how they looked after me and managed to nurse me back to some sort of health before I came out. Really, they were incredible. At the end, even though it was hard on it because I was still on oxygen, I had an exercise bike in my room. I had all the elastic bands that the lads use now to strengthen things up. So, you know, I had everything in my room. Physios coming around and seeing me. And at the end there, an incredible specialist in a lady called Katrina Curtis, who, without her at the end, I'm not quite sure where I would have been, because the steroids were not working enough. I mean, if you have 5 milligrams to 7 milligrams of steroids a day, that's probably enough. And she came in and she gave me 3 kilo hits, 3,000.
Wow.
In 3 days. And I think that was the kick that made me start to recover. I think without that hit, and that was quite a dangerous hit, you shouldn't be having really that much. But I think when it got to that point, it was tough, if you know what I mean.
At any point, were you worried for your life, Steve?
Yeah, probably. I've said this a few times. I remember when I was up in, it's funny because when I was up in intensive care, that was actually the time where I was least worried, if that makes sense. And yet you're in intensive care, but I maybe maybe there were more drugs in intensive care. I remember there was a mention of me going to sleep or something. They like to have you either on the side or on your front. It's incredibly difficult if you don't sleep like that to be on your front and try and breathe, but they want your lungs to be open on the back. So you've either got to sit like that or you've got to sit with your, or lie on your side. So you're opening your lungs up at the back. They don't want you to actually lie on your back. And I said, I wasn't really keen on going to sleep. So I didn't want any of that, going on, because, you know, I said, if I'm going to go anywhere, I want to be awake knowing I'm going somewhere. I don't want to be asleep and then not wake up from it. So I didn't have that. And I know they had to give me what was called a tocilizumab injection, these small injections. I think they're about £500 a hit. And I had to have six of them because they had to lower then my immune system even more, because that's how they need to get the steroids to work. And then for 90 days, you're vulnerable to everything. So that made it even longer where I couldn't have my vaccine. So I think I remember coming out and then going back down onto the ward. And then I remember being poorly on the ward. I had what was called a PICC line inserted just underneath my bicep, and it had to come into my chest and then down to my heart, because I'd had so many needles and so many injections that it was incredibly difficult to keep trying to find veins when you're dehydrated. I think I must have been on a hydration drip for nigh on the time I was in, within 2 or 3 months. So the PICC line, when the PICC line got inserted, it actually punctured my lung. So then all the oxygen that was going in was coming back out. If you can imagine just a normal balloon, if you put a pinprick in the neck of the balloon and then try and keep blowing the balloon up, it doesn't matter how much you try to blow that balloon up, unless you put your finger over that hole, that balloon is never going to get to its size. So I think the air that was going into my lungs was escaping back up, which caused the emphysema in my neck, which was, I don't know, you know, really, really, really uncomfortable, you know, because I felt as though there was a choking effect on me then, where my windpipe would be narrowed. And I remember one guy saying to me one day, you know, you need to give us a shout if you feel as though you're getting any real tightness in your throat and choking. So your next question is then, why, what are you going to do? So he said, we'll have to pierce a hole in your neck, like, you know, and put a tracheotomy in there. So I said, oh, that's handy. So look, it's what they would have had to done to save anyone's life. And, you know, there would have been a lot of people out there that have been really brave and they've had to have that done, if you know what I mean. So thankfully they didn't need to do that with me, but it was incredibly uncomfortable. That probably it went on for about 2 weeks. But having said that, I think I'm coming out of all of it. I don't ever like to take it for granted, but I think I'm coming out of it. I remember doing a lot of work down the gym and trying to get back on the watt bike in the summer to try and be just fit enough to be here on July the 1st. And I think what's happened now, my fitness levels, I was better and stronger to be able to come through the door. But now trying to do the fitness work and do the work, I found it a little bit hard. So I've managed to do quite a few sessions on the watt bike, but probably I need to try and get myself to do a little bit more on that when I've got the energy for it, really. But I will. It will just take me a little while longer. And people keep saying to me about patience, but they're the ones, they know the answer when they say to me about patience, that I haven't got too much of it, really.
And the other side of this, I think, that has shocked you no end is the amount of goodwill messages you got, Steve. I mean, yeah. we're talking thousands, aren't we?
Yeah, no. Yeah, I had probably over about 2,000 text messages and voicemails that, you know, that I hadn't, it took me ages to reply to everybody. And in every message I sent back, there was an apology for not being able to come back sooner. But I mean, the messages were incredible, you know. I had messages from every level of football, all the way through the pyramid, from non-league up to international managers that contacted me. It was overwhelming, really. The people that had contacted me that I hadn't even spoken to maybe for years, but had remembered things we had done together. So, you know, I can't thank anybody enough, really. I don't think I'll ever be able to do that. But their support was, it was so important, really. It was so important. You know, when you think there's people that are out there that are caring for you, and that was something I'll never forget.
Listen, mate, sorry you've been through it, but thanks for being so inspirational in sharing what you've been through.
Yeah.
And will you come back on later in the season, and can we talk football on that occasion?
Yeah, that will be good. Yeah, that'll be good. We'll talk about some football then. But in the meantime, look after yourself and everybody. If you've had this and you're coming out the other end, great, fantastic, well done.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, bye-bye.
The official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Wow, that was some listen, wasn't it? I don't know how we follow that. But who better to help us preview the new EFL season as a whole and compare suntans with me, of course, than the former Nottingham Forest, Southampton, Leeds United, Colchester United, Swindon Town, Sheffield Wednesday, Scunthorpe United, and Coventry City midfielder and now Sky Sports main EFL presenter, David Prunt. You were laughing, mate, because you've already seen mine, and I'll be honest, it's a no contest. I win.
Come
this
on.
Year.
It's exquisite. Hey? Yours is absolutely, it's even. It's deep, it's rich. That's just your voice. And the tan does obviously back it up. So no, but mine's built in the North Yorkshire moors, whereas yours is a little bit more exotic, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And we should say as well, we're at different periods of our life. I'm a very old man who only has himself to...
Who tans better?
No, but I don't have to think of a couple of lovely children who need looking after on a holiday as well. So I can just about manage to go off for a few days in beating sunshine, which has given me this mahogany queue and the look of a Malteser, let's be perfectly frank.
Can I just before you crack, any Paul Hopper this year, or have you kept it? Did you keep it to your own base?
Well, let me just tell you, I'll be perfectly frank with you. I spent 6 nights in the city of Alicante, beautiful old town. There's a city beach, it's magnificent. If I have one bit of advice to the mayor of Alicante, there's a foot washer for when you come off the beach, but we could do with freshwater showers for those of us that on the final day of the holiday are going to get a late flight back. Yes. Thankfully, though, the apartment I was in was absolutely beautiful, and they had a shower room for this exact purpose. I was able to book it, so come back to the apartment where I'd left my suitcase in a locker for the day while I went to knock out some final rays. Quick shower, because I don't like to go home with sea salt lotion all over me. I like to put some fresh clothes on as I dropped back into Heathrow, so all was well. You are referring to a previous incident where, quite coincidentally, Prutz and I found ourselves in the same resort, had no idea. I tried to jump in a hotel I wasn't staying in's pool just to get some
my
of the...
My pool, basically.
Your pool, yeah. To get the beach grime off, only to find... only to find I had this voice yelling across the pool. Oi, imposter! Imposter! Or words to that.
The beach grime. I've got visions of my very small son swimming through beach grime in this swimming pool as you were just washing off. Have you nice and clean, Clem? Cheers, mate. My son just swam through a plaster.
Oh dear, oh dear. Okay, shall we try and get back in the groove, because obviously 138 EFL matches plus 15 Carabao Cup ties and the semi-finals and the final of the Papa John's Trophy on Sky Sports this season. You'll be figureheading a lot of those EFL matches. I mean, do you leave it to the last minute before you do your preparations? Who's gone where? Which manager's changed club? No, seriously. Do you need to sort of zone out altogether for a couple of weeks and then catch up, or do you keep your hand in? What's your approach,
you
David?
Ticking along. It's obviously a topic and a passion of mine that I love dearly. So you're always kind of keeping an eye on what's going on, who's going well, and obviously with dabbling here and there with bits and bobs of social media, it's hard to miss things, isn't it, with regard to who possibly could be going somewhere or who's mooted to go somewhere. So it's always nice to have that bit of a decompress. We come to this glorious pinnacle of the season, which we've been lucky enough, haven't we, Clem, to be at Wembley to see these types of games in the playoff finals, and then getting there, hearing the roar of actual people in the crowd, and just enjoying it for what it was, and then yeah, you have a bit of a decompress, but it's not something I find remotely stressful doing. I just love every single minute of it. So you have a bit of downtime, and then probably like you, you're ready and raring to go again, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly that. Having had my 6 days of lying on the beach and then getting the grime off in your pool. Well, not this year. I can't help but feel, and I know when there's a big tournament, it does kind of shorten the EFL close season, if that makes sense, because it doesn't feel quite as long without football. But I can't help but feel, and particularly when I look at the transfer market, that it's been a very quiet summer and a reflection of the £250 million of lost gate revenue that 72 EFL clubs have lost. Because apart from Harry Wilson's 12 million transfer to Fulham, I could pick out the two Reading guys departing. Michael Olise has gone for 8 million to Palace. Omar Richards on a free to Bayern Munich. Apart from that, does it feel like a really quiet summer that we've had and a reflection of the times?
Yeah, it does. And I think, and I don't, as much as if you're a football fan who's looking at your team and wondering where your squad's going to go this season and wanting, we like action, don't we? We like movement, we like business being done. I think, and this is me preempting the collective opinion of football fans in general, I think we all understand that, don't we? I think we're all, it's a reflection, like you say, across the world of what we've what we've all had to deal with, and it seems fitting as well. Maybe, I mean, you look at the Premier League, and that's its own entity. And just before we came on, discussing possible transfers that are north of £100 million with some very, very famous players, of course. But I think with what we've seen in the EFL, the real dedication, hard work, commitment to getting the football back, getting the season finished in a relatively normal manner, I think there is that reflection of, yes, we've managed to do that, but the next year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, season on season might have to be dealt with a bit more frugally. And I think possibly in the longer run and for the longer term health of football clubs in general, that might be the most prudent way to go forward.
Well, I think the buzzword from the EFL's perspective is sustainability. They would like a financial reset. They would like a fairer distribution of revenues, because obviously the gap between the bottom Premier League club getting £100 million and Norwich City winning the title in the Championship is, I think, about £100 million to 8 million. So they'd like that staggering reset. It is. It's a hell of an adjustment. They'd like cost control. They'd like to make sure that all owners come in with secure funding. So I guess it is. I mean, I would actually suggest that we'll struggle to match the 12 million that Fulham were able to pay for Harry Wilson with the rest of the money laid out across the 72 clubs over the summer. It's certainly looking that way,
yeah,
isn't it?
I can see that. And what goes into that is we've seen Fulham attack the Premier League in two different ways, haven't we, in recent seasons. One was spending upwards to about 100 million. The other one was a bit more prudent, whereas what they've got with Harry is a player that we all think is fantastic. We all enjoy watching, can do it on the international stage, and he's still trying to get to a point where he can consistently affect a football match with the ability that he's got. So now the ball's been thrown slightly back in his court. He's found a home, hasn't he, for the foreseeable. Now the pressure's on for him to produce, and that's where you really find and test the mettle of a footballer, when there's been a lot of questions about where he was going to finally kind of land himself permanently. This is a place where hopefully the fans are going to see the best of him.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Fulham are the overwhelming favourites in the Sky Bet Championship. Just before we go through the rest of the runners and riders, I mean, I always love that first Saturday of the season, because optimism abounds. Even if you've had a rubbish season the year before, you still have that hope and dream that it might be your year. Serious grown-up question. We've all got our own perceptions of risk with COVID. There'll be a lot of football fans, I'm sure, can't wait to get back. Players and managers can't wait to have supporters in the stands. But there will be some, I guess, some caution out there that football will need to take into account. I.e., there will be some people who haven't been out and about during COVID, like you and I have, to go to work and stuff like that. And it will take a little while for that confidence to build up, and all supporters everywhere need to be on good behaviour and not cramming into tight areas where everybody's banked up against each other. I mean, it's an important point, probably, isn't it?
It is, and I'll be intrigued to see how it pans out. We're at Bournemouth on Friday, obviously, so you get the fans in. We're pitch side, hopefully. I mean, I'm looking out the window now, it's a glorious day, and sod's Lord say, come the first game of the season, they'll be belting it down, stood there with brollies on the side of the pitch. But I think, hopefully, it's going to stay nice. So, like you, Clem, I'm intrigued to see that. Off the back as well of watching the Euros, seeing crowds in, obviously seeing what happened in and around the final, speaking to friends and colleagues of mine that were actually in and around Wembley and them being taken very much aback by the sheer volume of people, which we've not seen in one single place for the best part of 18 months, how that affects you as a human being, not being in there, and the approach of some people, and I say some people, it's not the majority by any stretch of the imagination, where the last 18 months were completely forgotten. So I think we've spoken all across it about, hopefully it brings a reset, the fans, we act in a way, and when I'm talking about the global kind of sense of what football is, and hopefully there's that genuine human empathy for each other to think, well, take the mask situation, for example. I'm sure you've been in places over the last couple of weeks where you go into a shop, some people have them on, some people have them and don't have them on, and you've got to respect the fact that there's now that freedom of choice. And if that's the case, then make sure we all respect each other's space, a little bit of ground that they, or pocket of space that they're going to spend an hour and a half watching a football match in, and just enjoy it for what it is, live sport that we've all missed so much, but with that respect for each other.
Yeah, but with the return of fans comes the responsibility that there will be people who have different perceptions, different interpretations of how far they're prepared to go, in what close proximity to others. And it's perhaps not the time to be overly boisterous and jumping on top of a complete stranger or pushing to get down a tight corridor into a ground and things. It's just the responsibility is across us all to make sure that we don't have any more false starts and the fans are back for good. Fulham, West Brom, Sheffield United, all got new managers. Marco Silva is in at Fulham. Valerian Ismail has swapped Barnsley for West Brom. And Slavisa Jokanovic takes over at Sheffield United. Your thoughts on those appointments?
I think let's start with Valerian going in at West Brom. Very intrigued because of what he did with Barnsley. I think we all respected what he did with Barnsley, didn't we? Very much so, with regard to how they set up as a team, how they set up as a group of individuals, and how they played in a way which was an assault on the senses, I think, to a certain degree at times, wasn't it? But he led that team way beyond possibly the expectations. I think what they managed to do under him was fantastic. Really intrigued to see what he does, with the greatest respect, with a better set of players, although there is that kind of Pereira poser that's going on at the moment, I think, with regards to how he deals with that type of player. But he seems to me to have the characteristics, going back to Valerian, the characteristics and the physicality to front up and lead a team such as that. So I'm really, really intrigued to see how he goes about it. With Slavisa, we know he's a man that can get teams promoted to the Premier League. I think with regards to what he's got on his hands at Sheffield United, it was so indoctrinated in the way that Chris Wilder wanted them to play, and his status as a legendary figure in their recent history is there and secured, I think, regardless of what happened in the second season in the Premier League. They did so unbelievably well to get to where they got, and how they managed to achieve that. They start again with a different manager, again another manager who, there'd be no quarter given on the sidelines, would there? But can you imagine those two, Valerian and Slavisa, going up against, I'm not saying they're going to start knocking each other out, but I think you've got two very, very sizable dudes there going up against each other. And obviously Marco Silva, what he did at Hull City, much beloved at Hull City, and his work at Everton. I still think, to a certain degree, the jury's out a little bit. A prolonged season of good work instead of little bursts here and there, I think, is what the people that perhaps are questioning Marco Silva want to see.
So we've got Fulham, West Brom, Sheffield United. Scotty Parker has moved to Bournemouth. I guess those four are the ones everybody are going to look at.
Yes, it's hard to train your eyes away from that, with the greatest respect to everyone else. But
I have a kind of little list of what I'm calling if, buts and maybes. Mm-hmm. And I've got Cardiff in there under Mick McCarthy. Yep. Only lost three games since he took over. I still think, despite they're in their fourth year in the EFL and their parachute payments have gone, Stoke City, mm-hmm. those clean sheets during a period last season, if they could add a bit of firepower or get Tyrese Campbell back, could be
in there.
Well,
he was a
huge
miss, wasn't he, when Tyrese fell off? He seemed the form did as well, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Middlesbrough I'm intrigued by, not just because I think everybody knows they are my team, but the signings, when you start pulling in a couple of players that have just been relegated, I'm thinking of Ikpezu with coming in from Wickham and Crooks coming in from Rotherham. I look and think, well, they're not the sort of star signings Middlesbrough were making when they were paying 15 million quid for Britt Assambalonga 4 seasons ago, but Neil Warnock's steely determination. I mean, who else would be in there? Would Forrest? Would you put them in that pack as well?
They've got to start doing something, haven't they? Was it 21 years since the last in the top flight? Just going back to the Borough situation, I think sometimes we look at those types of signings. We look at, say, you talk about Britt going for that amount of money, and you look at perhaps Matt Crooks coming in, who was fantastic, wasn't it, at Rotherham? He was such a big part of what they were about, and those games that he was suspended for, it's very hypothetical. You just don't know where Rotherham's future may have ended up if he'd have been available for those, and Nick Piazza as well. He seems like a real Neil Warnock player, doesn't he? The kind where he can be indulgent enough to go and perform and create something. So maybe that's a slightly different way of going about it, of building a collective rather than splashing out on one, means that they're going to have a bit more of an even output. With Forrest, I'm intrigued. I really am intrigued because for them, given how much of a toil last season was off the back of what was a disastrous overshot of trying to get into the playoffs the year before, it really seemed to derail them, didn't it? Sabri Lamouche obviously paid the price for that. Chris came in and made them harder to beat as they moved steadily away from what was trouble. I'm intrigued to see Lewis go again. I think Lyle Taylor, I think even he would admit that his much heralded joining of Forest didn't quite manifest itself in the number of goals that he's used to scoring, so as a challenge for him. And the younger lads with Alex Might and the pace that he's got, and Brennan Johnson, fantastic at Lincoln, fantastic, much sought after as well. So whether he's around to be able to show Forest fans how one of their own leads the line going forward with the type of pace and trickery that he's got, there's a potential there for them to have something to really cheer about. The only part of what that collective is and has a question mark is the centre of the pitch. I don't know whether at this moment in time they've got the legs and the intricacy to be able to unlock teams. But if you've got a decent three going forward, make yourself solid and see where you end up.
I mean, we should mention Barnsley had a brilliant season. Marcus Schopp has taken over, led TSV Hartberg to their highest ever finish in the Austrian Bundesliga and into the Europa League for the first time, has a reputation for developing young talent. I feel a little bit sorry for MK Dons as well to have lost their manager Russell Martin 1 week before the start of the season, because he is the man who has taken over at Swansea City, beaten playoff finalists, and clearly, circumstances weren't right for Steve Cooper to have departed just a couple of weeks before the start of the season.
Yeah, it's, and there was that little kind of strange holding period, wasn't there, where that he was helping the club get to the next appointment, which must have been, well, I presume it's akin to somebody moving in your house as you're moving out and going off to pastures. And I'll keep the bed warm until you're ready and then one off. But I think I text Russell again, another, I must have played against him a very, very long time ago, as I was on the slippery slope down to the nether regions of the Football League and he was on the crest of a wave becoming what he became. But he's a very, very good talker, but that talk is backed up, I think, with substance. There's been some good interviews I've read where he's been challenged by journalists and, you know what we're like, shove a camera up a microphone, tell us, why didn't that happen today? Why didn't that work today? And he explained very methodically what he was about, and I think he did really well with MK, and I think he played in a way that MK fans would really would enjoy. And Swansea have got a really good manager whose career is in its infancy, who's ambitious, who's dedicated, who's committed, who's got great ideas, and is looks like the very embodiment of what it is to be a coach in the modern day. So expectation levels will be there. There must be something awry. I don't know whether it might be that classic thing where, and you see it time and time again, don't you, where a manager is frustrated because of what is afforded to him or what isn't afforded to him. He goes out the door, a new manager comes in. Oh, look, we found a couple of hundred grand under the sofa. Do you want to honour for a player? Yeah, brilliant, that'd be fantastic. Suddenly, it's a little bit different, isn't it? Fresh eyes on a same squad can sometimes garner different results. So again, really looking forward to see what Russell does with the Swans.
Well, we're not going to list every single team. Obviously, we'll get to everybody over the course of the season and reflect on. Mm. Have I missed anybody on that list? Should I pull QPR out? Would they be ones to look out for?
Second half of the season, from what we saw, there's definitely something there. That the fact that the players that they brought in on loan, vast majority have been turned into permanent signings, again, seems good business sense. They've seen what these players, take a Charlie Austin, for example, what are they still capable of? Brilliant, you've done your bit, let's go again. Ilias Chair, another player that you'd be well-versed to keep an eye out on, who can change a football match. So there is something in that, because you mentioned Cardiff earlier on, Clem, didn't you? And it was that sense of how well they did under Mick and then ran out of steam, that how well the QPR had done under Mark Warburton in the second half of the season. If they hadn't given themselves so much work to do in the first half, it could have been a completely different set of circumstances come the end of the season. So definitely someone there. Intrigued to see what Lee does, Bowie, with Birmingham, what they're with them going into this season relatively stable. Again, you say that from a championship perspective, which could mean by next week or the start of September, everything's gone out the window. But the transformation in what he brought to that side was fantastic. So whether that's a case of them hitting the ground running, again, another one to look out for.
And the only other one I was going to chuck into the mix is a potential surprise package. They probably won't thank me for thrusting them into the limelight. But canny recruitment and all that, Luton Town, Cameron Jerome, yep, Henry Lansbury, Carlos Mendes Gomez, who got fantastic, the winning goal that took Morecambe into the third tier for the first time. Lovely story. Well, we must get him on and chat to him, actually. Born in Senegal, he moved with his dad at the age of three to Lanzarote for his dance work. Then he had a cousin who lived in Madrid, so he took himself off to stay with him. Got a trial with Atletico Madrid's academy, had a couple of years there. Then his dad said, "You've got to move with us to Manchester." And the family must stay together, had to regroup. Ninth tier of English football, playing for his college team, discovered by Morecambe, and now Nathan Jones is taking a chance on him. And I love stories like that, you know.
It's amazing, and it dovetails into what Nathan's about as well. 22, really good age that Nathan's going to get hold of this player, and allied to, like you say, with Cameron Jerome and what that team did last season, the finish that they had. I don't think enough was made of it, considering what we'd seen the season before, when Nathan came back, had to prove his doubters wrong, dragged them to safety, and then what they managed to do last season. I think you're absolutely right, and maybe it'll be one of those where if Nathan's listening, he'll be thankful of the nod, but he'll also be, can you just keep it down a little bit? Because I quite enjoy kind of going under the radar and working my way through it. But also as well, I mean, the other side of it, with the news coming out with about Mick Harford as well, a man that I've come across in a professional capacity as he was working in the hierarchy at Luton with Paul Hart. I mean, Paul Hart and Mick Harford on the touchline, there's two men that you don't mess with at all, do you? And I think the outpouring and the reflection of what and the high regard that people hold him in really does reflect what he's done throughout several decades of football. And again, just we wish him all the best, don't we?
Yeah, of course we do. In his fight with cancer, he's got prostate cancer, as we do in fact Michael Appleton as
absolutely,
well, with his fight against testicular cancer. The manager of Lincoln City. So Friday night is Bournemouth West Brom, and then Sunday 1:30 kickoff is Fulham Middlesbrough. Is that one of yours as well?
We've got a double header, and then we've got Coventry Forest following that, which is their glorious return to, you can't say the Ricoh because it's not the Ricoh, it's the CBS, isn't it? That's where Coventry are playing back at the weekend, which I think is fantastic. I dipped my toe in there for what was the best part of 2 months at the very end of my career, playing at Northampton Town, which the very first Saturday I turned up to Six Fields thinking, decent crowd here today, isn't it? and there's a big shopping centre next to Six Fields and a cinema. And the majority were going in there, but the real diehards were on a hill behind the home end.
It's brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah, which, and I think it's just great for them to get back up, played at when it was the Rico, and just that what that team is, what that club is. Again, what Mark did, keeping him, getting him in the division, staying in the division, and making a decent fist of themselves back in the Championship. Again, maybe there's a team in there that has got nice, quiet aspirations of a top half finish.
Good luck to everybody this season in the Championship. I've been doing some research, David. Ooh. Prepare to be shocked. Because I think you look at League One and you look at all those big clubs. Bolton now, Charlton Athletic, Ipswich Town, Portsmouth, Sheffield Wednesday, Sunderland, Wigan Athletic and all the rest. But I had a little look at the managers and get this. Of the 24 managers, 18 have achieved at least one managerial promotion.
Wow.
8 of them have been promoted from League One. I'll just mention any of them that have got more than one. Paul Cook's got 3. The Cowleys have got 5. Nigel Adkins has 4. Paul Warner's 2. Ian Everett has 2. Gareth Ainsworth has 2. Simon Grayson has 4. Steve Evans, I've been conservative with that. I'm saying 6. Sometimes he tells me it's 9. John Coleman has 4. Ryan Lowe has 2. Steve Cottrell, we heard from him earlier and all that he went through with 5. And cumulatively, get this, that means those 18 managers have achieved a whopping 46 promotions. I mean, talk about experience. So we've got the battle between the big clubs. Mm-hmm. But what about that lot going head to head and all that expertise? It's extraordinary.
It's a genuinely interesting stat. You know the stats that we sometimes discuss and what they're there for, whether it's illumination or just a proper point, rather akin to what a drunk man uses a lamppost for. There's two different ways of how you break that down, isn't it? But it is, and it goes to show. I mean that to me, and we've seen, haven't we, in recent seasons in League One, that battle to get out of it has been fantastic, and it's been spread very widely until the kind of final knockings of the season. And hopefully, with what you're saying there, it really does put that into the mix going forward into the season. Because no doubt, I mean, the managers that you're talking about there, the managers that have all achieved what is a really hard thing to do. I think there's a presumption sometimes as a layperson, you're a favourite to get promoted, so you just go and get promoted. But then you've got the variables that are involved in each individual game across each individual season are vast and varied, and that's what they've got to manage to try and work through. It's Ipswich, you mentioned Paul and what he's got there. It seemed to be a strange old season, didn't it? Because we had the fans locked out and not allowed to attend the games, yet they seemed to be more vociferous than ever in their dislike of what their club was going through and how it was being run and what they were seeing. And the attitude and the magnetism of what Paul's about. He was very blunt and honest, wasn't he, about the job that he's got on his hands. Now he's put himself right at the forefront of that to lead them going forward this season. So they're, like you say, the one of the big names. Sunderland, meekly falling out of the playoffs, need to go again. And now with that investment that they've had, it was that investment came in at a certain time when obviously you couldn't spend it on players or recruitment from that point of view. But from what I've heard, there's been some very solid investment behind the scenes on the kind of the fundamentals of what it takes to make a football club click. So again, we'll see what comes from them. Wickham with Gareth is amazing, isn't he? I can't sing that man's praises enough. What he does with that team, how close they were to staying in the Championship was phenomenal, really. And as you say, with Lincoln and the Cowleys down at Pompey, again another team that missed out with a whimper when it came to trying to get into the playoffs. There's so many variables, there's so many people there with points to prove, and I can't wait for it to all get cracking.
Couple of fixtures that catch the eye: Sunderland against Wigan. I mean you say all the investment in Sunderland. Slightly curious that Charlie Wyke, having scored so many goals, has moved to Wigan in the close season, an immediate return to the Stadium of Light.
It was, yeah, I mean, the intricacies, we've mentioned a transfer before we came on, which we might come on to in due course, about sometimes you're kind of scratching your head a little bit, because again, you'd watch the results come in, and more often it would be McGeady Cross, Wakeheader, and it'd just be that yeah. seemed to be their MO, didn't it, in the way that they were yeah. approaching games. And he did, I mean, such a threat in the box, such a threat, and a real talismanic presence for Sunderland. And you see them going to what could be potentially a key rival. But again, the intricacies, the minutiae of what that transfer may have involved, we don't quite know. But I thought he was a player that seemed to have settled and found his feet at Sunderland.
Amongst the favourites in Sky Bet League 2, Mansfield Town, who just have not got going the last few years. Bristol Rovers will carry heavy ambitions of bouncing straight back, as will Tranmere. Mickey Mellon's return to them. Bradford City, Derek Adams, new manager going in there despite leading Morecambe to promotion last season. I guess Northampton as well in that mix. There's some big hitters. I can't help but see that Salford are the favourites once again. A well-known Sky Sports pundit does like to tinker and try and get things right at his beloved football club, doesn't he?
He does. He's an ambitious fella leading a team of ambitious people, isn't he? A very, very, I mean, stellar footballing career, stellar punditry career so far. All-round good egg as well, Gary. I'll give him that. He's been good as gold with me whenever I've come across him. And they're in a hurry to get promoted, aren't they? Not in a unrealistic sense, I don't think. But when they've changed their manager, it's more often than not when they've been in a position where other teams are scratching their heads and fans are scratching their heads, aren't they? When it comes to moving on when teams look to be doing relatively well. But I think with Gary in charge, I mean, it was only just within 2 points of the playoffs last season, wasn't it? Which maybe felt like it was a decision that they made a little bit too late, even though I really do enjoy and appreciate the way that Richie Wellens gets teams playing football. So, yeah, it does feel like in recent seasons we've always kind of fixated on what Salford have done. But there was a key game last season, Salford against Bolton, where Bolton hadn't started too well, had they, under Ian? And what Ian then went on to do with Bolton off the back of putting four, I think, past Salford, really kick-started their season. That's kind of not a cautionary tale, but a way of showing that you of going about the division in a certain way. Bradford, I think, If we're talking about Derek going in there and the monumental achievement of him getting Morecambe promoted, it was a wonderful day out at Wembley watching that. And Bradford City, fans of a certain generation will look at where they are and just kind of scratch their heads in utter frustration and disbelief. But this again, the variables are there. Bristol Rovers, it's not been a quiet off-season, shall we say, for many different reasons, but now's the time for them to do the talking on the pitch, isn't it? And when I say them, I mean them as a collective, i.e. from the top down.
Yeah, but I, the other part of League Two is what catches my eye is some first-time managers stepping out from either youth development or assistance role. Rob Edwards was with the England setup, was with Wolves under 23s. He's taken the Forest Green Rovers job. Matthew Taylor, as we now appear to be calling him, has come from Spurs under 18s to take charge of Walsall. And Robbie Stockdale stepped out. Yes. I mean, assistant at Sunderland
Perennial
to
assistant.
Moisey.
And Borough, wasn't he?
And Big Sam.
Yeah, everywhere.
Yeah, and now he's got the Rochdale job. I mean, it's good that these guys are getting the chance to step out and do things in their own name.
It's fantastic. I'll have to text Matthew Taylor. I didn't realise he'd know. That's probably why I didn't answer my last one. I called him Matty.
Well, we've got, it does mean we will have Matt Taylor facing Matt Taylor at one stage when Exeter play Walsall, doesn't it? And obviously we've got Matty Taylor at Oxford as well. So maybe the Matt, Matty and Matthew will help us distinguish so we don't make fools of ourselves on air.
I don't need any help making a fool of myself, Clem, you know that. And again, it's tough, isn't it? These lads that step out of the shadows and having spoken to Matthew when he was in at Tottenham, that little kind of development role, I think players of a certain ilk and reputation, he had a fantastic career and played it up until the very last knock-ins. I think there's a certain bracket of player that could get kind of ensconced in a position such as that, not put the head above the parapet and just, you know what I mean, just kind of work nicely along away from the glare of it all. And more power to someone like him to step forward and someone like Robbie Stockdale as well, having spent that much time learning, you think, from the managers that he's been alongside. Been very intrigued to see the way that he puts that out. It's tough, isn't it? Because, again, we've seen clubs at the bottom end of this division fight over the last few seasons. Swindon Town's one that it sticks out because of how well they've done under Richie. Richie then moves on. Again, another team beset by problems off the pitch. And having had a modicum of an experience there, I mean, the year that I were there, we were no good whatsoever. We were put together to try and get into the Championship. We ended up that season getting relegated to League Two, and I'll be honest, there's not many Swindon fans that bid me a fond farewell, and quite rightly so, because we were atrocious. But they were a passionate bunch, a noisy bunch, a bunch that knows what good football looks like and how well a football club should be run. And at this moment in time, they're not getting that. And I hope the season is about survival and moving forward rather than it being one long staring down the barrel of something not very pleasant.
Although they do now finally have a new owner. So those four managers last season and just a couple of weeks ago, only five first-team players, a manager in John McCrill who quit after just a month. They do have a new manager or head coach in Ben Garner. And they have been taken over. He was a minority shareholder. Now he's taking them over. Clem Morfuni or Morfunny? I think he's got quite a good first name, don't you think?
He has, and Clem Morfunny sounds something that myself and producer Dave scream at you all the time, I think, doesn't it?
I set that up magnificently for you, didn't I? Great to see you, Pruts. We're looking forward to you holding it all together for us all season.
Fingers crossed. That's what we do. We enter it with hope, fearlessness, joy. And a spring in our step, though. So I'll see you along the line, my friend.
That's it for this episode. Big thank you to David Prutton, and great to have Steve Cottrell back at the forefront of the game. If you've enjoyed it, please do give us a 5-star rating, press the subscribe button, and share on your socials. If you'd like to get in touch, our email address is podcast@efl.com. That's podcast@efl.com. My name's Mark Clement. Thanks very much for listening. Football is back. Join us again soon for another episode of
The Official EFL Podcast.